Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Tom McMahon, number 7068, representing Dr. Crowe, plaintiff and appellant. This litigation is judicial review of Penrose Hospital's revocation of Dr. Crowe's clinical privileges there. In recent years, there have been various legal and administrative proceedings, as I know Judge Daly knows, between Dr. Crowe and Penrose. All of that began back in October of 2004, at a time when Dr. Crowe was chief of surgery at competing Memorial Hospital down in Colorado Springs, and his privileges were then suspended by Penrose over a short few-hour delay in getting a patient into surgery for the routine repair of a gallbladder that was leaking air. Surgery took 25 minutes. It was successful. The patient continued to recover under Dr. Crowe's care, but a week later he was summarily suspended over the alleged delay in initiating the surgery. After he was taken off the patient's care, another physician gave her steroids, which Dr. Crowe would not have allowed because it could cause the surgical repair to fail. That's exactly what apparently happened. The patient's condition deteriorated and she died several weeks after that.
He had started this proceeding, though, hadn't they, before she died?
They summarily suspended Dr. Crowe 1 week after the surgery, and during that period of time, she was doing okay. Then she got the steroids, and then her condition deteriorated.
Right, but the suspension had nothing to do with her subsequent condition. It had to do with whatever
delay.
Thank you, counsel.
And that delay led to the peer review. That's what brings us here today. But in the interim, the Board of Medical Examiners conducted a full 14-month investigation into the matter. It determined that no formal disciplinary proceeding was necessary and issued a simple letter of admonition regarding the delay. Now, the briefs address several issues. I'm going to take my time here to try to highlight just one or two of them. The most critical one, I believe, are the subpoenas under the Colorado Professional Review Act. Particularly the section is 12-36.5-104(10)(B). There's a Roman numeral 2 subsection and a Roman numeral 3 subsection that are at issue here. Roman numeral 2 applies in an administrative appeal. It says that the records of peer review committees shall be subject to subpoena and available for use in any appeal pursuant to this Part 1. Part 1 is Sections 101 to 106 of 36.5 of Title 12. And the only time the word appeal is used in there is in the context of an administrative appeal to the governing board. That term is used 6 times. It's used in prior subsections of Section 104, always in that context.
Mr. McMahon, what Mr. Sabe argues in his brief, and it sounds like the district court agreed, that under your interpretation of this statutory provision, it would be anomalous to say that you would be given access to records after an evidentiary hearing for purposes of appeal. What is your response to that?
The hospital's own bylaws provide for exactly that. There is a provision which we cited in our brief, which I believe is Part M, Section 4B, if I have my citation here in my notes correct, that says that in your appellate arguments to the appellate review panel, you can submit any facts that were not previously available to or not considered by the hearing panel. So there is a specific provision that tracks with the statute.
Can you tell me, though, generally what your understanding is as to why the General Assembly would have promulgated or enacted a statute that seems at odds with the normal way in which access to information is provided to litigants?
As we all know, sometimes the General Assembly does things that causes all of us to scratch our heads. In this case, I believe what went on was you go to the hearing. If there's no adverse consequence from the hearing, there's no need to be able to go back and get the peer review committee records. But if there is an adverse consequence from at the evidentiary hearing, then the ability is there for either side in the administrative appeal to go back and get the source records from the peer review committees and use it in the appeal.
And use it to what extent? Is it a new evidentiary hearing?
No, you're simply able to submit that evidence. In other words, what you would be entitled to is defined in the statute in section 102, what are the records of peer review committees? And it's investigative reports, it's notes, it's memos, and the Supreme Court delineated all that in the Franco opinion at page 925 and footnote 3. Does a laundry list, and it talks about the investigatory materials.
But I'm still having trouble understanding this, because given your interpretation, let's say you have access to the records of the professional review committee or committees, and there's something there that says, some doctors say, well, I really don't like Dr. Crow, I've never liked him, and it's something that at an evidentiary hearing you could use to, presumably, to impeach the decision of the professional review committee, but how could you use it for purposes of
that? I think on the appeal, what you would be able to do is to say, see, this decision was not made on the merits. It wasn't substantively correct. You could argue, because that's what you would be doing, you'd be arguing to impeach the decision itself. In this particular case, I think what the evidence would show was that this was a kangaroo court, that the Credentials Committee was supposed to conduct an investigation. It had all the way from October 7th until November 10th, and it didn't do anything. And then on November 10th, the Surgical Peer Review Committee met. It sends recommendations to the Credentials Committee. Same day, Credentials Committee meets. It considers whatever it considered. It sends recommendations to the MEC, and the MEC then notifies Dr. Crow that these recommendations are adverse. So nothing happened for a month and a half, and then all of a sudden, in one day, these committees jumped on it. That's what we're trying to get at. That's what this would show, and it would show that the recommendation was flawed from the get-go.
Can I ask a question? Are you saying that you did not have the right to present these at the evidentiary hearing?
That's correct, Your Honor, because we tried to get them and they say, oh,
when? Just exactly when did you try to get them?
We subpoenaed them in the appellate review portion.
Right, right. But did you try to subpoena them for the evidentiary
hearing? We did not try to subpoena them for the evidentiary hearing because there really isn't a provision that provides for that. The provision in 12-36.5-10410B, Roman numeral 2 provides for it in the administrative appeal, and that's what we relied on. So I would agree that the statute is somewhat anomalous, but the statute says what it says, and it's very clear what it says, and the legislature is presumed to have intended exactly what it said.
Should these two clauses be read together, subject to subpoena and available for use in an appeal? In other words, they should be.
I think that they should.
Let me ask the question, please. If you read them together, wouldn't that mean that they should be subject to subpoena at the evidentiary hearing and then available for use in an appeal?
I did not read it that way, Your Honor. I don't believe it. That whole clause
is it subject to that reading? Is it subject to the reading that I proposed?
I don't think it's subject to that reading. I think the way the language is laid out, it is directed to the appeal. Subject to subpoena and available for use in any appeal, and then again in any judicial review proceeding in Roman numeral 3.
Subject to subpoena, the way you're reading it, in a suit seeking judicial review, is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm saying that it's subject to subpoena on the appeal. That's under Roman numeral 2, and then it's subject to subpoena in a judicial review suit under Roman numeral 3. That's how I read it, Your
Honor. Let me ask you this. Would it be independently subject to subpoena if you didn't appeal it, if you didn't subpoena it for the appeal, could you still subpoena it for the judicial review?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because you could just go under number 3, number 3.
Even though judicial review is almost always limited to the record that's before the board as opposed to created for the first time in the courts?
I do understand that, Your Honor, but that is what the statute provides, and you go all the way back to the Franco opinion in 1982, and the Supreme Court said over and over and over again, even though that wasn't a judicial review case, they kept making the example that in judicial review, the physician can get all this material because that is the one check on flawed proceedings. So we did, of course, again, subpoena this in the judicial review suit under Roman numeral 3. The district court quashed the subpoena.
So your position, counsel, is that Franco will support your proposition that you could subpoena this for use in a judicial review, even though you had not subpoenaed it or obtained it for use in the administrative process?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's definitely clear from Franco. And admittedly, Franco, the statute at the time of Franco didn't talk about administrative appeals. It just talked about judicial review. But I think it's abundantly clear. The one other point I want to address, and then I want to just reserve my time, is that we believe that the judicial review here should have been conducted under the APA, because the Crow case, the opinion in 2007, the Supreme Court makes clear that private hospital peer review is administrative action under state law.
But Mr. McMahon, that opinion from the Supreme Court didn't, as I read it, refer to the APA at all. Is that correct?
It did not, Your Honor. I'm saying you take that language, you take what they said there, and then in the Riles case back in 2000, they said that private peer review committees operate as an arm of the BME. And you take that and you take the change in the language in 1989, where there was a much more comprehensive statutory framework enacted, so that the Board of Medical Examiners had ultimate control over the private peer review committees. And then you put the gloss of these two decisions on top of that after that statutory change, and that's where you come out. And I'm going to reserve the rest of my time, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. McMahon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Mark Sabe. Registration number 16319, representing Penrose St. Francis Hospital. Just to respond briefly, the Franco case specifically states that judicial review is limited to the record made before the governing board. States that specifically. The Crow case, it does not support...
Excuse me. How do you square that with the language, which he didn't give us a cite, but under part three of Franco, it does have a statement, the records of review committee or a hospital board may be subpoenaed in a suit brought by the physician seeking judicial review. So what are we to make of that language?
Yes, they can be subpoenaed, but what is subpoenaed? So you have to have subpoena power to issue a subpoena. In this case, there is, in judicial review, you can issue a subpoena, but that's to get the record. What's relevant as a matter of administrative law is the record of the proceedings before the governing board. You don't interject new issues on judicial review.
What other type of judicial review or even administrative review requires subpoenaing the records before the board or the record upon which the board acted? What other statute requires that?
Yeah, I don't know of any others, but the reason it's important here is because the statute provides a peer review privilege and says the records are not subject to subpoena and not subject to discovery. And so without some kind of an exception, you couldn't review the record.
Mr. Sabe, I understand your explanation with regard to the saying that applies to the governing board, but the statute also applies to the records of a professional review committee. So what do you think the legislature had in mind when it said that you could subpoena records of a professional review committee?
Well, first of all, it's a good question, because the term professional review committee is a broad term. It includes the governing board. They function as a professional review committee when they're...
Right.
And also the hearing panel is a professional review committee. And so you have a variety of different levels of professional review committees.
What about, including the investigating arm? Is that correct?
Yes, those are professional review committees as well.
So doesn't that mean that a physician should be able to obtain the records of any or all of those professional review committees?
No, the reason is because as a matter of administrative law, and Franco said this very clearly, the review is limited to the record made before the governing board.
But how do you reconcile that language in Franco with the statutory language?
Because it says that these records that are relevant to the judicial review, which wouldn't be available otherwise because of the privilege, are subject to subpoena. But it's not saying that every single record is relevant because judicial review is limited to the record.
Right, I understand that, but what I'm having trouble with, Mr. Savy, is trying to understand the General Assembly's language and to determine whether or not there is anything at all that any doctor could ever subpoena from a professional review committee under your interpretation of the statute.
Well, again, the doctor does subpoena if the records are not made available automatically, which we did in this case. We provided the record, all the record of the hearing. We provided the record of the proceedings before the governing board, and both of those are done on a record and are required to be done on a record pursuant to statute so that those can be used in appeal.
Right, but there were other professional review committees that were operative here, isn't that correct?
Yes.
So again, let me ask you, how does the statute apply, if at all, to the records of those other professional review committees?
Yeah, I think just a quick answer is that the statute allows you to subpoena what's relevant for the judicial review proceeding. Without that authority, you wouldn't be able to get what you need for the judicial review proceeding. But it does not provide for post-governing board discovery of things that were never presented in the administrative process. That would be an anomaly.
Can I ask you a different question, Matt?
Yeah.
Or maybe the same question in a different way. Are you saying that the records that Dr. Crow was seeking cannot be subpoenaed at all?
Yes.
So...
Let me explain that.
All right. Keep that one in mind.
Yeah.
The second question I have is, if they were subject to subpoena, when should they have been subpoenaed?
Okay, I think I can answer both of those questions.
Okay.
So, first of all, in the record already is all of the correspondence between the initial peer review committees and Dr. Crow. So you have all of the correspondence between them. That's part of the record already. You also have Dr. Crow's correspondence back to the committees. Dr. Crow wrote a letter to the surgical peer review committee before, which is a subcommittee of the credentials committee, and that letter is found in the record beginning at page 1090. And so, all of the correspondence related to the initial peer review process is in the record. It's not privileged because it's given to the physician, and so that's automatically turned over. Now, a quick review of the peer review process provides a clear explanation for why discovery related to pre-hearing proceedings is unnecessary, and why the relevant statutes do not provide